The oral surgeon and his minions were still there and occupying roughly the same positions in his field of vision as they had been when he started to utter this sentence, but now the oral surgeon's glasses were askew and the lenses misted with blood, and his face was all sweaty and his mask flecked with tiny bits of stuff that very much looked like it had come from pretty far down in Randy's body. And the air in the room was murky with aerosolized bone, and his nurses were limp and haggard and looked like they could use makeovers, facelifts, and weeks at the beach. Randy's chest and lap and the floor were littered with bloody wads and hastily torn open medical supply wrappers. The back of his head was sore from being battered against the headrest by the recoil of the young brilliant oral surgeon's cranial jackhammer. When he tried to finish his sentence, "So if you're willing to pay the premium, I think the switch to NT would be very well advised," he noticed that his mouth was jammed full of something that prevented speech. The oral surgeon pulled his mask down off his face and scratched his sweat-soaked beard. He was staring not at Randy, but at a point very far away. He heaved a big, slow sigh. His hands were shaking.
"What day is it?"
Randy mumbled through cotton.
"As I told you before," the brilliant young oral surgeon said, "we charge for wisdom tooth extractions on a sliding scale, depending on the degree of difficulty."
He paused for a moment, groping for words.
"In your case, I'm afraid that we'll be charging you the maximum on all four."
Then he got up and shambled out of the room. Weighed down, Randy thought, not so much by the stress of his job as by the knowledge that no one was ever going to give him a Nobel Prize for what he had just accomplished. Randy went home and spent about a week lying on his couch in front of the TV eating oral narcotics like jelly beans and moaning with pain, and then he got better. The pressure in his skull was gone, just totally gone. He cannot even remember now what it used to feel like. Now, as he rides in the police car to his new private jail cell, he remembers the whole wisdom tooth extraction saga because of its many points in common with what he just went through emotionally with young America Shafto. Randy's had a few girlfriends in his life. Not many, but all of them were like oral surgeons who just couldn't cut the mustard. Amy's the only one who had the skill and the sheer balls to just look at him and say, "Okay," and then tunnel into his skull and come back with the goods. It was probably exhausting for her. She will extract a high price from him in exchange. And it will leave Randy lying around moaning with pain for a good long while. But he can tell already that the internal pressure has been relieved, and he is glad, so glad, that she came into his life. And that he finally had the good sense and, arguably, guts to do this. He completely forgets, for a few hours, that he has been marked for death by the Philippine government. From the fact that he's in a car, he infers that his new private cell is in a different building. No one explains anything to him because he is, after all, a prisoner. Since the bust at Naya, he's been in a jail down south. A newish concrete block number on the edge of Makati, but now they are taking him north into older parts of Manila, probably into some more stylish and gothic pre-war facility. Fort Santiago, on the banks of the Pasig, had cells that were in the intertidal zone, so that prisoners locked into them at low tide would be dead by high. Now it's a historical site, so he knows they're not headed there. The new jail cell is indeed in a big, scary old building somewhere in the torus of major governmental institutions that surrounds the dead hole of Intramuros. It is not in, but it is right next to a major court building. They drive through alleys among these big old stone buildings for a while and then present credentials at a guardhouse and wait for a big iron gate to be rolled aside. And then they drive across a paved courtyard that hasn't been swept out in a while and present more credentials and wait for an actual portcullis to be winched up, clearing an orifice that ramps them down beneath the building itself. Then the car stops and they are abruptly surrounded by men in uniforms. The process is uncannily like pulling pulling up to the main entrance of an Asian business hotel. Except that the men in uniforms carry guns and don't offer to tote Randy's laptop. He has a chain around his waist and manacles attached to that chain in front, and leg chains that shorten his stride. The chain between his ankles is supported in the middle by another chain that goes up to his waist, so that it will not scrape the ground as he walks. He has just enough manual dexterity to grip the laptop and keep it pressed up against his lower abdomen. He's not just any chained wretch. He is a digital chained wretch. Marley's ghost on the information superhighway. That a man in his situation is being allowed to have a laptop is so grotesquely implausible that it causes him to doubt even his own supremely cynical assessment of it, namely that someone, presumably the same someone who is sending him a message, has already discovered that everything on the hard drive is encrypted, and is now trying to gull him into firing the machine up and using it so that what? Maybe they've rigged up a camera in his cell and will be peering over his shoulder. But that would be easy for him to defeat. He just has to not be completely stupid. The guards lead Randy down a corridor and through some prisoner check-in stuff that doesn't really apply to him since he has already filled out the forms and turned over his personal effects at another jail. Then the great big scary metal doors commence, and corridors that don't smell so good, and he hears the generalized hubbub of a jail. But they take him past the hubbub and into other corridors that seem to be older and less used, and finally through an old-fashioned jailhouse door of iron bars and into a long vaulted stone room containing a single row of maybe half a dozen cells, with a guard's passageway running along past the doors of the iron cages. Like a theme park simulacrum of a jail. They take him all the way down to the last cell and put him there. A single iron bedstead awaits him, a thin cotton mattress with stained but clean sheets and an army blanket folded and stacked on top of it. An old wooden filing cabinet and folding chair have been moved into the cell and placed in one corner, right against the stone wall that is the terminus of this long room. The filing cabinet is evidently meant to serve as Randy's work table. The drawers are locked shut. This cabinet has actually been locked into place with a few turns of heavy chain and a padlock, so it's very clear that he is expected to use the computer there, in that corner of the cell and nowhere else. As Attorney Alejandro promised, an extension cord has been plugged into a wall outlet near the cell block entrance, and run down the passageway and securely knotted around a pipe out of Randy's reach, and the tail end of it allowed to trail across in the direction of the filing cabinet. But it does not quite reach into Randy's cell, so the only way to plug the computer in is to set it up on that cabinet and stick the power cord into the back and then toss the other end out through the iron bars to a guard who could mate it with the extension cord. At first, this appears to be just one of these maddening control freak things, an exercise of power for the pure sadistic pleasure of it. But after Randy's been unchained and locked in his cell and left alone for a few minutes to run through it in his head, he thinks otherwise. Of course, normally, Randy could leave the computer on the card table while the batteries charged and then carry it over to his bed and use it there until the batteries ran down. But the batteries were removed from the machine before Attorney Alejandro gave it to him, and there don't seem to be any ThinkPad battery packs lying around his cell, so he will have to keep it plugged in all the time. And because of the way they have set up the filing cabinet and the extension cord, he is forced, by certain immutable properties of three-dimensional Euclidean space-time, to use the machine in one and only one place. Right there on top of that damn filing cabinet. He does not think this is an accident. He sits down on that filing cabinet and scans the wall and ceiling for over-the-shoulder video cameras, but he doesn't look very hard, and he doesn't really expect to see one. To make out text on the screen, they would have to be very high-resolution cameras, which would imply big and obvious. Subtle pinhole cameras wouldn't do it. There aren't any big cameras around here. Randy becomes almost certain that if he could unlock that filing cabinet, he would find some electronic gear inside. Directly underneath his laptop, There is probably an antenna to pick up Van X signals emanating from the screen. Below that, there is some gear to translate those signals into a digital form and transmit the results to a listening station nearby, probably right on the other side of one of these walls. Down in the bottom are probably some batteries to make it all run. He rocks the cabinet back and forth as much as the chains will allow and finds that it is indeed rather bottom-heavy, as if there's a car battery sitting in the bottom drawer. Or maybe it's just his imagination. Maybe they are letting him have his laptop just because they are nice guys. So, this is it then. This is the setup. This is the deal. It is all very clean and simple. Randy fires up the laptop just to prove that it still works. Then he makes his bed and goes and lies down on it, just because it feels really good to lie down. It is the first time he's had anything like privacy in at least a week. Notwithstanding Abby's bizarre admonition against self-abuse on the beach in Pacifica, it is high time that Randy took care of something. He needs to concentrate really hard now, and a certain distraction must be done away with. Replaying his last conversation with Amy is enough to give him a good erection. He reaches down into his pants and then abruptly falls asleep. He wakes up to the sound of the cell block door clanging open. A new prisoner is being let in. Randy tries to sit up and finds that his hand is still in his pants, having failed to accomplish its mission. He pulls it out of there reluctantly and sits up. He swings his feet down off the bed and onto the stone floor. Now he's got his back to the adjacent cell, which is a mirror image of his. That is, the beds and the toilets of the two cells are right next to each other along their shared partition. He stands up and turns around and watches this other prisoner being led into the cell next to his. The new guy is a white man, probably in his 60s, maybe even 70s, though you could make a case for 50s or 80s. Quite vigorous, anyway. He's wearing a prison coverall just like Randy's, but accessorized differently. Instead of a laptop, he's got a crucifix dangling from a rosary with great big fat amber beads, and some sort of medallion on a silver chain, and he's clutching several books to his belly, a Bible and something big and in German, and a current best-selling novel. The guards are treating him with extreme reverence. Randy assumes the guy is a priest. They are talking to him, asking him questions, being, Randy thinks, solicitous to his needs and desires. And the white man answers them in reassuring tones and even tells a joke. He makes a polite request. A guard scurries out and returns moments later with a deck of cards. Finally, the guards back out of the cell, practically bowing and scraping, and lock him in with apologies that start to get a little monotonous. The white man says something, forgiving them wittily. They laugh nervously and leave. The white man stands there in the middle of his cell for a minute, staring at the floor contemplatively, maybe praying or something. Then he snaps out of it and starts looking around. Randy leans into the partition and sticks his hand through the bars. "Randy Waterhouse," he says. The white man frisbees his books onto the bed, glides toward him, and shakes his hand.
"Enoch Root," he says. "It's a pleasure to meet you in person, Randy."
His voice is unmistakably that of Pontifex, root@eruditorum.org. Randy freezes up for a long time, like a man who has just realized that a colossal practical joke is being played on him, but doesn't know just how colossal it is or what to do about it. Enoch Root sees that Randy is paralyzed and steps smoothly into the gap. He flexes the deck of cards in one hand and shoots them across to the other. The queue of airborne cards just hangs there between his hands for a moment, like an accordion.
"Not as versatile as ETC cards, but surprisingly useful," he muses. "With any luck, Randy, you and I can make a bridge. As long as you're just standing there pontificating anyway."
"Make a bridge?" Randy echoes, feeling and probably sounding rather stupid.
I'm sorry. My English is a bit rusty. I meant bridge as in a card game. Are you familiar with it?
Bridge? No, but I thought it took four people.
I have come up with a version that is played by two. I only hope this deck is complete. The game requires 54 cards.
54, Randy muses. Is your game anything like Pontifex?
One and the same.
I think I have the rules for Pontifex squirreled away on my hard drive somewhere, Randy says.
Then let's play, says Enoch Root.
Fall. Shafto jumps out of the airplane. The air is bracingly cold up here, and the wind chill factor is something else. It is the first time in a year that he has not been loathsomely hot and sweaty. Something jerks mightily on his back, the static line still attached to the airplane. God forbid that American fighting men should be entrusted to pull their own ripcords. He could just imagine the staff meeting where they dreamed up the concept of the static line.
For God's sake, General, they're just enlisted men. As soon as they jump out of the airplane, they'll probably start daydreaming about their girlfriends, take a few hits from their pocket flasks, catch 40 winks, and before you know it, they'll all pile into the ground at a couple of 100 miles an hour.
The drogue chute flutters out, catches air, and then eviscerates his main pack in one jerk. There's a bit of flopping and buffeting as Bobby Shafto's body pulls the disorganized cloud of silk downwards. Then it thunks open, and he is left hanging in space, his dark body forming a small, perfect bullseye in the center of the off-white canopy for any Nipponese riflemen down below. No wonder those paratroopers think they are gods among men. They get such a nice view of things. So much better than a poor marine grunt stuck down on the beach, who is always looking uphill into courses of pillboxes. All of Luzon stretches out before him. He can see 100 or 200 miles north, across a mat of vegetation as dense as felt, to the mountains in the far north where General Yamashita, the Lion of Malaya, is holed up with 100,000 troops, each of whom would like nothing better than to strap lots of explosives to his body, sneak through the lines at night, run into the middle of a large concentration of American soldiers, and blow himself up for his emperor. To Shafto's starboard is Manila Bay, and even from this distance, some 30 miles, he can see the jungle suddenly turn thin and brown as it nears the shore, like a severed leaf that is dying from the edge inwards. That would be what's left of the city of Manila. The fat 20-mile-long tongue of land protruding towards him is Bataan. Just off the tip of it is a rocky island shaped like a tadpole with a green head and a bony brown tail. Corregidor. Smoke jets from many vents on the island, which has been mostly reconquered by the Americans. Quite a few Nipponese blew themselves up in their underground bunkers rather than surrender. This heroic act has given someone in the general's chain of command a nifty idea. A couple of miles from Corregidor, motionless on the water, is something that looks like an absurdly squat, asymmetrical battleship, except much bigger. It is encircled by American gunboats and amphibious landing forces. From a source on its lid, a long wisp of red smoke trickles downwind. A smoke bomb dropped out of Shafto's plane a few minutes ago on a parachute. As Shafto descends and the wind blows him directly towards it, he can see the grain of the reinforced concrete of which this prodigy is made. It used to be a dry rock in Manila Bay. The Spanish built a fort there. The Americans built a chain of gun emplacements on top of that, and when the Nips showed up, they turned the entire thing into a solid reinforced concrete fortress with walls 30 feet thick and a couple of double-barreled 14-inch gun turrets on the top. Those guns have long since been silenced. Shafto can see long cracks in their barrels and craters like frozen splashes in the steel. Even though he is parachuting onto the roof of an impregnable Nipponese fortress, chock full of heavily armed men who are desperately looking for a picturesque way to die, Shafto is perfectly safe. Every time a nip pokes a rifle barrel or a pair of binoculars out of a gun slit, half a dozen American anti-aircraft gunners open up on them at point-blank range from the nearby ships. A tremendous racket ensues as a small powerboat pops out of a little cave along the waterline of the island and heads directly towards an American landing craft. 100 guns open fire on it simultaneously. Supersonic bits of metal crash into the water all around the little boat, ton after ton of them. Each bit makes a splash. All of the splashes combine into a jagged volcanic eruption of white water centered on the little boat. Bobby Shafto puts his fingers in his ears. 2,000 pounds of high explosive packed into the little boat's nose detonate. The shockwave flashes across the surface of the water, a powdery white ring expanding with supernatural velocity. It hits Bobby Shafto like a baseball to the bridge of the nose. He neglects to steer his chute for a while and trusts the winds to carry him to the right place. The smoke bomb was dropped as proof of the concept that a man on a parachute might actually be able to land on the roof of this fortress. Bobby Shafto is, of course, the final and irrefutable test of this proposition. As he gets closer and his head clears from the explosion, Shafto sees that the smoke bomb never actually reached the roof. Its little chute got tangled up in the briar patch of antennas growing out of the top of the thing. All kinds of fucking antennas. Even during his days in Shanghai, Shafto had a weird feeling around antennas. Those Station Alpha pencil necks in their little wooden roof shack with all the antennas sprouting from it, those were not soldiers, sailors, or marines in the normal sense. Corregidor was covered with antennas before the Nips came and took it. And everywhere that Shafto went during his detachment 2702 stint, there were antennas. He is going to spend the next few moments concentrating very hard on those antennas, and so he turns his head for a moment to get a bearing on the American LCM, the landing craft that the NIP suicide boat was hoping to destroy. It is exactly where it is supposed to be, halfway between the encircling force of naval ships and the sheer 40-foot-high wall of the fortress. Even if Shafto didn't already know the plan, he would, at a glance, identify this vessel as a landing craft, mechanized, Mark III, a 50-foot-long steel shoebox designed to cough a medium-sized tank up onto a beach. It has a couple of 50-caliber machine guns on it, which are pounding away dutifully at various targets on the wall of the fortress, which Shafto cannot see. But from his vantage point on high, he can see something that the Nipponese can't. The LCM is not carrying a tank, in the sense of a vehicle on caterpillar treads with a gun turret. It is carrying, rather, a tank in the sense of a large steel container with pipes and hoses and stuff attached to it. The Nips in the fortress are taking pot shots at the approaching LCM, but the only target at which they have to aim is its front door, a piece of metal that can flop down to become a ramp, and which was designed, incredibly enough, on the assumption that doomed Nips would spend a lot of time trying to blow holes in it with various projectile weapons. So the defenders are not getting anywhere. Anti-aircraft gunners on other ships have begun raking the walls of the fortress insanely, making it hard for the Nipponese to poke their heads and their gun barrels out. Shafto notes fragments of antennas skittering and bouncing across the roof of the fortress, and occasional streaks of tracers, and hopes that the men on those ships have the presence of mind to hold their fire before he lands on the fucking thing, which will be in a few seconds. Shafto realizes that his mental concept of what this mission was going to be like, as he reviewed it with the officers in the LCM, bears no relationship to the reality. This is only about the 5,000th time Shafto has experienced this phenomenon in the course of the Second World War. You'd think he would no longer be surprised by it. The antennas, which look wispy and inconsequential on the reconnaissance photos, are in fact sizable engineering works. Or they were, until they got de-engineered by the naval gunfire that silenced those big guns. Now they are just wreckage of a sort that is going to be peculiarly nasty to parachute down on top of. The antennas were, and the wreckage is, made of all kinds of different shit. Spars of Philippine mahogany, sturdy columns of bamboo, welded steel trusses. The most common bits are the ones that catch a parachutist's eye. Long metal pokey things and miles of guy wire snarled into a briar patch. Some of it taut enough to cut a plummeting Marine's head off, and some of it all loose and tangly with sharp hovering ends. It dawns on Shafto that this pile isn't just a gun emplacement. It's a NIP intelligence headquarters.
"Waterhouse, you fucking son of a bitch!"
Shafto hollers. As far as he knows, Waterhouse is still in Europe. But he realizes as he's clapping his hands protectively over his eyes and falling into the nightmare that Waterhouse must have something to do with this. Bobby Shafto is landed. He tries to move, and the wreckage moves with him. He is one with it. He opens his eyes carefully. His head is wrapped up in a snarl of heavy wire, a guy wire that broke under tension and whipped around him. Peering between loops of wire, he sees three lengths of quarter-inch metal tubing projecting out of his torso. Another one has gone through his thigh, and yet another through his upper arm. He's pretty sure he has a broken leg, too. He lies there for a while, listening to the sound of the guns all around him. There is work that needs to be done. All he can think of is the boy. He gropes for the wire cutter with his free hand and begins to cut himself loose from the snarl. The jaws of the wire cutter just barely fit over the metal tubing of the antenna. He reaches behind himself, finds the place where the tubes poke into his back, and cuts them off. Snip, snip, snip. He cuts the tube that has impaled his arm. He leans forward and cuts the one that goes through his leg. Then he pulls the tubes out of his flesh and drops them on the concrete. Plink, 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 plink. Lots of blood follows. He doesn't even try to walk. He just begins to drag himself across the concrete roof of the fortress. The sun has warmed the concrete, and it feels good. He cannot see the LCM, but he can see the few antennas that stick out of its top, and he knows it is in position now. The rope should be there. Shafto props himself up on his elbows and looks. Sure enough, there it is. A manila rope, natch, tied to a grapnel. One point of the grapnel lodged in a shell crater near the edge of the roof. He gets to it eventually and begins to pull on the rope. He closes his eyes, but tries not to fall asleep. He keeps pulling, and eventually feels something big and thick between his hands. The hose. Almost finished. Lying on his back, hugging the end of the hose to his chest, he rolls his head from side to side until he can see the air vent that they picked out on the reconnaissance photos. It used to have a sheet metal hood on the top of it, but that's long gone now. It's just a hole in the roof with a few jagged bits of metal at its edges. He crawls over to it and feeds in the end of the hose. Someone must be watching him on one of the ships, because the hose stiffens, like a serpent coming alive. And between his hands, Bobby Shafto can feel the fuel oil streaming through it. 10,000 gallons of the stuff, straight down into the fortress. He can hear the nips down there singing hoarse songs. By now, they will have figured out what is about to happen. General MacArthur is giving them exactly what they've been praying for. At this point, Bobby Shafto is supposed to sail down a rope into the LCM, but he knows it isn't going to happen. No one can reach him now. No one can help him. When the fuel oil stops streaming through the hose, he summons all the concentration he has left. Pretends, one last time, that he actually gives a damn. Jerks the safety pin from a white phosphorus grenade, lets the handle fly off and tinkle merrily across the roof. He can feel it come alive in his hand, the thrumming animal fizz of its inner fuse. He drops it into the air shaft. A circular pipe, straight down, a black disc centered on a field of dingy gray, like the ashes of a Nipponese flag. Then, on an impulse, he dives in there after it. Semper Fidelis. Dawn star flares on disk of night. I fall. Sun rises. Metis. The appearance of Root at eruditorum.org in the cell right next to Randy's is like the crowning plot twist in this Punch and Judy show that has been performed for his benefit ever since his plane landed at Naya. As with any puppet show, he knows that there must be a lot of people just outside the range of his senses, in furious motion, trying to make it all happen. For all he knows, some significant fraction of the Philippine gross national product is being devoted to keeping up these pretenses for his benefit. There is a meal waiting on the floor of Randy's cell, and a rat on top of the meal. Randy usually reacts pretty badly to the sight of rats. They rupture the containment system that his upbringing and his education built around the part of his mind where the collective unconscious stuff dwells, and send him straight into Hieronymus Bosch territory. But in these circumstances, it doesn't bother him any more than seeing one at the zoo would. The rat has a surprisingly attractive buckskin-colored pelt, and a tail about as thick as a pencil that has evidently run afoul of a farmer's wife with a carving knife, and woggle stiffly in the air like the blunt antenna of a cell phone. Randy is hungry, but he doesn't want to eat anything that a rat has left footprints on, so he just watches it. His body feels like it slept for a long time. He turns on his computer and types in a command called date. The nails of his left hand look funny, as if they all got bruised. Focusing on them, he sees a club drawn in blue ballpoint pen ink on the nail of the index finger, a diamond on the forefinger, a heart on the ring finger, a spade on the pinky. Enoch Root told him that in Pontifex, as in bridge, each card in the deck has a numerical value. Clubs, 1 through 13. Diamonds, 14 through 26. Hearts, 27 through 39. Spades, 40 through 52. Randy drew the symbols on his nails so he wouldn't forget. Anyway, date tells him that he apparently slept all of yesterday afternoon and evening, all night and about half of today. So this rat is actually eating his lunch. Randy's computer runs Finex, so when it boots up, it gives him a black screen with big fat white letters scrolling up it one line at a time, a real circa 1975 type of user interface. Also, presumably, the easiest possible thing to read through Van Eck freaking. Randy types in Start X, and the screen goes black for a moment, and then turns a particular shade of indigo that Randy happens to like, and beige windows appear on it, with much smaller and crisper black letters. So now he is running the X Windows system, or X, as people like Randy call it, which provides all of the graphical junk that people expect in a user interface. Menus, buttons, scroll bars, and so on. As with anything else under Unix, of which Finex is a variant, there are a million options that only young, lonely, or obsessed people have the time and patience to explore. Randy has been all three at various times of his life and knows a lot about these options. For example, the background of his screen happens to be a uniform indigo at the moment, but it could be an image. Theoretically, you could use a movie so that all of your windows and menus and so on would float around on top of, say, Citizen Kane running in an endless loop. You can, in fact, take any piece of software and make it into your screen background, and it will purr along happily, doing whatever it does and not even known that it's being used as window dressing. This has given Randy some ideas on how to approach the Van Eck thing. In its current state, this computer is just as vulnerable to Van Eck freaking as it was before Randy started up X. Before, it was white letters on a black background. Now it's black on beige. The letters are a little smaller and they live in Windows, but it makes no difference. The electronics inside his computer still have to make these transitions between 0 and 1, that is, between high intensity, white or beige, and minimal, black, as they trace out these patterns of dots on the screen. Randy fundamentally does not know what the fuck is going on in his life right now, and probably hasn't for a long time, even back in the days when he thought that he did know. But his working hypothesis is that the people who set this whole situation up, prime candidates, the dentist and his cohorts in the Bolo Bolo Syndicate, know that he has some cool information on his hard drive. How should they know this? Well, Pontifex, the wizard, Enoch Root, whatever the fuck he's called, when he phoned Randy on the plane, knew that Randy had Arethusa, so God knows who else might know. Someone set up the fake drug bust at Naya so that they could nab his laptop and yank the hard drive and make a copy of its contents. Then they found out that it was all doubly encrypted. That is, the Arethusa intercepts are encrypted to begin with in a pretty good World War II cryptosystem, which anyone should be able to break nowadays, but on top of that, they are furthermore encrypted in a state-of-the-art modern system that no one can break. If they know what's good for them, they won't even try to break it. The only way for them to get the information is to get Randy to decrypt it for them, which he can do by biometrically identifying himself to his laptop, by talking to it, or by typing in a passphrase that only he knows. They are hoping that Randy will decrypt the Arethusa intercept files and, like a moron, display their contents on the screen. The moment that stuff appears on the screen, the game is over. The dentists, or whoever's surveillance guys, can feed the intercepts to some kind of cryptanalytic supercomputer that will break them open in no time. That doesn't mean that Randy dare not open those files, just that he daren't display them on the screen. This distinction is crucial. Ordo can read the encrypted files from the hard drive. It can write them into the computer's memory. It can decrypt them and write the results into another region of the computer's memory and leave that data there indefinitely, and the Van Eck freakers will never be the wiser. But as soon as Randy tells the computer to show him that information in a window on the screen, the Arethusa intercepts will belong to the Van Eck freakers, and whoever they are, they can probably break them faster than Randy can. The fun and interesting thing is that Randy doesn't have to actually see those intercepts in order to work on them. As long as they are sitting in the computer's memory, he can subject them to every cryptanalytic technique in the whole Cryptonomicon. He starts tapping out some lines in a language called Perl. Perl's a scripting language, useful for controlling your computer's functions and automating repetitive tasks. A Unix machine, like this one, is rooted in a file system that contains tens of thousands of different files, mostly in straight ASCII text format. There are many different programs for opening these files, displaying them on the screen and editing them. Randy intends to write a Perl script that will roam through the file system, choosing files at random, opening each file in a randomly sized and located window, paging through it for a while, and then closing it again. If you run the script fast enough, the windows will pop open all over the place in a kind of rectangularized fireworks burst that will go on forever. If this script is used as the screen background, in place of solid indigo, then this will go on underneath the one window on the screen where Randy's actually working. The people monitoring his work will go crazy trying to track all of this, especially if Randy writes a script that will cause the real window to change its shape and location at random every few seconds. It would be really stupid to open the Arethusa intercepts in a window. He's not going to do that. But he can use this technique to conceal whatever else he's doing in the way of decryption work. It occurs to him, however, when he gets a few lines into writing this Perl script, that if he pulls a stunt like that so early in his incarceration, the people surveilling him will know right away that he is onto them. And maybe it's better if he lets them believe, for a while, that he suspects nothing. So he saves his Perl script and stops working on it for now. If he writes it in short bursts, opening it once or twice a day to type in a few lines and then closing it, it's unlikely that the surveillers will be able to follow what he's up to, even if they happen to be hackers. Just to be an asshole, he modifies his X-Windows options in such a way that none of the windows on the screen will have a title bar at the top. That way, the surveillance people won't be able to tell what file he is working on at any given moment, which will make it a lot harder for them to string a long series of observations together into a coherent picture of what's in his Perl script. 2, he opens up the old message from Root at eruditorum.org, giving the Pontifex transform, expressed as a few lines of Perl code. The steps that looked so unwieldy when carried out by a computer seem straightforward, easy even, now that he construes them as manipulations of a deck of cards.
Randy?
Huh?
Randy looks up from the screen and is startled to find that he is in a jail in the Philippines.
Dinner is served.
It is Enoch Root, looking at him through the bars. He points at the floor of Randy's cell where a new tray of food has just been slid in.
Actually, it was served an hour ago. You might want to have at it before the rats come.
Oh, thank you, Randy says. Making sure all the windows on his screen have been closed, he goes over and lifts his dinner up from the spatter of old rat turds on the floor. It is rice and lechon, a simple and traditional pork dish. Enoch Root finished eating a long time ago. He sits on his bed next to Randy and plays an unusual game of solitaire, pausing occasionally to mark down a letter. Randy watches the manipulation of the deck carefully, growingly certain that it is the same set of operations he was just reading about in the old email message.
"So, what are you in for?" Randy asks.
Enoch Root finishes counting through the deck, glances at a seven of spades, closes his eyes for a few moments, and marks down a W on his napkin. Then he says,
"Disorderly conduct, trespassing, incitement to riot. I'm probably guilty of the first two."
"Tell me about it."
"First, tell me what you're in for."
"Heroin was found in my bag at the airport. I stand accused of being the world's stupidest drug smuggler."
"Is someone angry at you?"
"That would make for a much longer story," Randy says. "But I think you have the drift."
"Well, in my case, it's like this. I've been working at a mission hospital up in the mountain."
"You're a priest?"
"Not anymore. I'm a lay worker."
"Where's your hospital?"
"South of here, out in the boondocks,"
Enoch Root says.
"The people there cultivate pineapple, coffee, coconut, bananas, and a few other cash crops. But their land is being torn apart by treasure hunters."
Funny that Enoch Root should suddenly be on the subject of buried treasure. And yet, he has been so tight-lipped. Randy guesses he's intended to play stupid. He takes a stab at it.
"Is there supposed to be some treasure down there?"
"The old-timers say that many Nipponese trucks went down a particular road during the last few weeks before MacArthur's return. Past a certain point, it was not possible to know where they went because the road was blocked and minefields set up to discourage the curious."
"Or kill them," Randy says. Enoch Root takes this in stride.
"That road gives way to a rather vast area in which gold might hypothetically have been hidden. Hundreds of square miles, much of it is jungle, much has difficult topography. Lots of volcanoes, some extinct, some vomiting up mud flows from time to time, but some is flat enough to grow tropical crops, and in those places, people have settled during the decades since the war and put together the rudiments of an economy."
"Who owns the land?"
"You've gotten to know the Philippines well,"
Enoch Root says.
"You go immediately to the central question."
"Around here, asking who owns the land is like complaining about the weather in the Midwest," Randy muses. Enoch Root nods.
"I could spend a long time answering your question. The answer is that patterns of ownership changed just after the war, and then changed again under Marcos, and yet again in the last few years. So we have several epochs, if you will. First epoch, before the war. Land owned by certain families."
"Of course."
"Of course. Second epoch, the war. A vast area sealed off by the Nipponese. Some of the families who owned the land prospered under the occupation. Others went bankrupt. Third epoch, post-war. The bankrupt families went away. The prosperous ones expanded their holdings, as did the church and the government."
"Why?"
"The government made part of the land, the jungle, into a national park. And after the eruptions, the church established the mission where I work."
"Eruptions?"
In the early 1950s, just to make things interesting, you know, things are never interesting enough in the Philippines, the volcanoes acted up. A few lahars came through the area, wiped out some villages, redirected some rivers, displaced many people. The church set up a hospital to help those people.
A hospital doesn't take up very much land, Randy observes.
We also have farms. We are trying to help the locals become more self-reliant.
Enoch Root acts like he basically does not want to talk about this.
At any rate, things then settled down into a pattern that more or less endured until the Marcos era, when various people were forced to sell some of their holdings to Ferdinand and Imelda and various of their cousins, nephews, cronies, and bootlicks.
They were looking for Nipponese war gold?
Certain of the locals have made a business of pretending to remember where the gold is,
Enoch Root says.
Once it was understood just how remunerative this could be, it spread like a virus. Everyone claims to have hazy memories of the war now, or of tales that Dad or Granddad told them. The Marcos-era treasure hunters did not display the cautious skepticism that might have been expected from people with more piercing intellects. Many holes were dug. No gold was found. Things settled down. Then, in the last few years, the Chinese came in.
Filipinos of Chinese ancestry or Chinese of Chinese ancestry, Enoch Root says.
Northern Chinese. Robust ones who like spicy food. Not the usual gracile Cantonese-speaking fish-eaters.
These people are from where, then? Shanghai? Root nods.
Their company is one of these post-Maoist monstrosities, headed up by an actual Long March veteran, wily survivor of many purges, name of Wing. Mr. Wing, or General Wing, as he likes to be addressed when he is feeling nostalgic, handled the transition to capitalism rather deftly. Built hydroelectric projects with slave labor during the Great Leap Forward, parlayed that into control of a very large government ministry, which has now become a sort of corporation. Mr. Wing has the ability to shut off the electricity to just about any home or factory or even military base in China. And by Chinese standards, this makes him into a distinguished elder statesman.
What does Mr. Wing want there?
Land. Land. More land.
What sort of land?
Land in the jungle, oddly enough.
Maybe he wants to build a hydroelectric project.
Yes, and maybe you're a heroin smuggler. Say, Randy, I don't think I'm rude for saying so, but you have sauce in your beard.
Enoch Root thrusts a hand through the bars, proffering a paper napkin. Randy takes it and, lifting it to his face, notes that the following letters are written on it. O-S-K-J-J, J-G-T-M-W. Randy pretends to daub sauce off his beard.
Now I've gone and done it,
says Enoch Root.
Given you my whole supply of bumwad.
Greater love hath no man, Randy says.
And I see you gave me your other deck of cards, too. You are too generous.
Not at all. I thought you might want to play solitaire, just as I did.
Don't mind if I do, Randy says, setting his dinner tray aside and reaching for the deck. The card on top is an 8 of spades. Skimming it and a few more cards out of the way, he finds a joker, with small stars in the corners. According to hints that Enoch has already dropped, this is the A joker. It's the work of a moment to slip it beneath the card below, which happens to be a jack of clubs. About 2/3 of the way down into the pack, he finds a big star joker. And B stands for big, so he knows that is joker B. He moves it down 2 cards below the 6 of clubs and the 9 of diamonds. Straightening up the pack and then smearing through it once more, he sticks various fingers in as he refines those jacks and ends up with a good half of the pack,
the full inter-joker span, plus the two jokers themselves, trapped between his index and forefingers. The thinner stacks above and below he pulls out and swaps with each other. Enoch watches all of this and seems to approve. Randy pushes out the bottommost card now, and it turns out to be a jack of clubs. On second thought, he pulls that jack out and leaves it on his knee for the time being so he won't mess the next part up. According to the mnemonic symbols he's marked on his fingernails, the numerical value of this jack of clubs is simply 11. So, starting from the top of the deck, he counts down to the 11th card, cuts the deck below it, then swaps the two halves, and finally takes the jack of clubs off his knee and puts it on the bottom of the deck again. The card on the top of the deck is now a joker. "What's the numerical value for a joker?" he asks, and Enoch Root says, "It's 53 for either one of them." So Randy gets a free ride this time. He knows that if he begins counting down from the top of the deck, when he reaches 53, he'll be staring at the last card, and that card happens to be the jack of clubs, with a value of 11. 11, then, is the first number in the keystream. Now, the first letter in the ciphertext that Enoch Root wrote on the napkin is O, and, setting the deck of cards down now so that he can count through the alphabet on his fingers, O is letter 15. If he subtracts 11 from that, he gets 4, and he doesn't even have to count on his fingers to know that letter number 4 is D. He has one letter deciphered. Randy remarks, "We still haven't gotten to your being arrested."
"Yes, well, it's like this," says Enoch Root. "Mr. Wing has been digging some holes of his own up in the jungle lately. A lot of trucks have been going through, ruining the roads, running over stray dogs, which, as you know, are an important food source for these people. A boy was hit by one of these trucks and has been in our hospital ever since. The runoff from Mr. Wing's operations has been fouling the river that many people rely on for fresh water. And there are questions of ownership, too. Some feel that Mr. Wing is encroaching on land that is properly owned by the government, which in some extremely attenuated sense means it is owned by the people."
"Does he have a permit?"
"Ah, once again your knowledge of local politics is evident. As you know, the normal procedure is for local officials to approach people who are digging large holes in the ground or undertaking any kind of productive or destructive activity whatsoever, and demand that they obtain a permit, which simply means that they want a bribe, or else they'll raise a stink about it. Mr. Wing's company has not obtained a permit."
"Has a stink been raised?"
"Yes, but Mr. Wing has forged a very strong relationship with certain Filipinos of Chinese ancestry who are well placed in the government, and so the stink has been unavailing."
The second time through, the joker moving part went quickly, since one of the jokers started out on top. The King of Hearts ended up on the bottom, and hence on Randy's knee. That son of a bitch has a numerical index of 39, and so Randy has to count most of the way through the deck to reach the card in the 39th position, which is a 10 of diamonds. He splits and swaps the deck, then puts the King of Hearts back on the bottom. Top card is now a 4 of diamonds, which translates to an index of 17. Counting the 17 top cards into his hand, he stops and looks at the 18th, which is a 4 of hearts. That works out to a value of 26 plus 4 equals 30. But everything here is modulo 26, so adding the 26 was a waste of time, because now he has to subtract it right off again. The result is 4. The second letter in Enoch's ciphertext is S, which is the 19th letter in the alphabet, and subtracting 4 from that gives him O. So the plain text, so far, is D-O.
I get the picture.
I was sure that you would, Randy.
Randy doesn't know what to make of the Wing business. It puts him in mind of Doug Shafto's yarns. Maybe Wing is looking for the primary, and maybe Enoch Root is too, and maybe the primary is what old man Comstock was trying to find by decrypting the Arethusa messages. Maybe, in other words, The location of the primary is sitting on Randy's hard drive right now, and Root's worried that Randy, like an idiot, is going to give it away. How'd he arrange to get into a cell next to Randy's? Presumably, the church's internal lines of communication are first rate. Root could have known for a few days that Randy was in the clink. Time enough to hatch a plan.
How'd you end up here, then? Randy asks.
We decided to raise a bit of a stink ourselves.
We being the church?
What do you mean by the church? If you are asking me whether the Pontifex Maximus and the College of Cardinals put on their pointy bifurcated hats and sat down together in Rome and drew up plans for a stink, the answer is no. If by church you mean the local community in my neighborhood, almost all of whom happen to be devout Catholics, then yes.
So the community protested or something, and you were the ringleader?
I was an example.
An example?
It frequently does not occur to these people to challenge the powers that be. When someone actually does, they always find it incredibly novel and derive much entertainment from it. That was my role. I had been making a stink about Mr. Wing for quite some time.
Randy can almost guess what the next two letters are going to be, but he has to keep working through the algorithm or the deck will get out of whack. He generates a 23 and then a 47, which, modulo 26, is 21, and subtracting the 23 and the 21 from the next two ciphertext letters, K and J, again modulo 26, gives him N and O as expected. So he has D-O-N-O deciphered. And continuing to work through it, one letter at a time, the card's getting a little sweaty in his hands now, he eventually gets D-O-N-O-T-U-S-E-P, and finally loses his place while trying to generate the last keystream letter. So now the deck is out of whack and completely unrecoverable, reminding him that he'd better be careful next time. But he can guess that this message must be, "Do not use PC." Enoch is worried that Randy did not anticipate Van Eck freaking.
So, there was a demonstration. You blocked a road or something?
We blocked roads. We lay down in front of bulldozers. Some people slashed a few tires. The locals put their ingenuity to work, and things got a bit out of hand. Mr. Wing's dear friends in the government took offense and called out the army. 17 people were arrested. Unreasonably high bail was set for them as a punitive measure. If these people can't get out of jail, they can't make money, and their families suffer terribly. I could get bailed out if I wanted to, but have elected to stay behind bars as a gesture of solidarity.
It all seems like a plausible enough cover story to Randy.
I'm guessing that a lot of people in the government are appalled by the fact that they have thrown a saint into jail, he says. And so they have moved you here, to the high-prestige luxury jail with private cells.
Once again, your understanding of the local culture is conspicuous, Enoch Root says.
He shifts position on the bed, and his crucifix swings back and forth ponderously. He also has a medallion around his neck with something startling written on it. Do you have some occult symbol there? Randy asks, squinting.
I beg your pardon?
I can make out the word occult on your medallion there.
It says ignoti et quasi occulti, which means unknown and partly hidden, or words to that effect, says Enoch Root. It is the motto of a society to which I belong. You must know that the word occult does not intrinsically have anything to do with satanic rituals and drinking blood and all of that.
I was trained as an astronomer, Randy says.
So I learned all about occultation, the concealment of one body behind another as during an eclipse.
Oh, well then, I'll shut up.
In fact, I know more than you might think about occultation, Randy says.
It might seem like he's beating a dead horse, except that he catches the eye of Enoch Root while he's saying it, and gives a significant sidelong glance at his computer. Root processes this for a moment, and then nods. Who's the lady in the middle? The Virgin Mary? Randy asks. Root fingers the medallion without looking at it and says,
Reasonable guess, but wrong. It's Athena.
The Greek goddess?
Yes.
How do you square that with Christianity?
When I phoned you the other day, how did you know it was me?
I don't know. I just recognized you.
Recognized me? What does that mean? You didn't recognize my voice.
Is this some roundabout way of answering my question about Athena worship v. Christianity?
Doesn't it strike you as remarkable that you can look at a stream of characters on the screen of your computer, email from someone you've never seen, and later recognize the same person on the phone? How does that work, Randy?
I haven't the faintest idea. The brain can do some weird...
Some complain that email is impersonal, that your contact with me during the email phase of our relationship was mediated by wires and screens and cables. Some would say that's not as good as conversing face-to-face, and yet our seeing of things is always mediated by corneas, retinas, optic nerves, and some neural machinery that takes the information from the optic nerve and propagates it into our minds. So is looking at words on a screen so very much inferior? I think not. At least then you are conscious of the distortions. Whereas when you see someone with your eyes, you forget about the distortions and imagine you are experiencing them purely and immediately.
So what's your explanation of how I recognized you?
I would argue that inside your mind was some pattern of neurological activity that was not there before you exchanged email with me. The root representation. It is not me. I'm this big slug of carbon and oxygen and some other stuff on this cot right next to you. The root rep, by contrast, is the thing that you'll carry around in your brain for the rest of your life, barring some kind of major neurological insult, that your mind uses to represent me. When you think about me, in other words, you're not thinking about me qua this big slug of carbon. You are thinking about the root rep. Indeed, someday, you might get released from jail and run into someone who would say, You know, I was in the Philippines once, running around in the boondocks, and I ran into this old fart who started talking to me about root reps. And by exchanging notes, as it were, with this fellow, you would be able to establish beyond a reasonable doubt that the root rep in your brain and the root rep in his brain were generated by the same actual slug of carbon and oxygen and so on. Me.
And this has something to do again with Athena?
If you think of the Greek gods as real supernatural beings who lived on Mount Olympus, no. But if you think of them as being in the same class of entities as the root rep, which is to say, patterns of neurological activity that the mind uses to represent things that it sees or thinks it sees in the outside world, then yes. Suddenly Greek gods can be just as interesting and relevant as real people. Why? Because in the same way as you might one day encounter another person with his own root rep, so if you were to have a conversation with an ancient Greek person, and he started talking about Zeus, you might, once you got over your initial feelings of superiority, discover that you had some mental representations inside your own mind that, though you didn't name them Zeus and didn't think of them as a big, hairy, thunderbolt-hurling son of a titan, nonetheless had been generated as a result of interactions with entities in the outside world that are the same as the ones that caused the Zeus representation to appear in the Greek's mind. And here we could talk about the Plato's cave thing for a while, the Vegematic of metaphors. It slices, it dices.
In which... Randy says, the actual entities in the real world are three-dimensional, real things that are casting the shadows. This Greek dude and I are the wretches chained up looking at the shadows of those things on the walls,
and it's just that the shape of the wall in front of me is different from the shape of the wall in front of the Grecian,
so that, given a shadow projected on your wall, is going to adopt a different shape from the same shadow projected on his wall, where the different wall shapes here correspond to, let's say, your modern scientific worldview versus his ancient pagan worldview.
Yeah, that Plato's cave metaphor. At this very moment, some wag of a prison guard out in the corridor throws a switch and shuts off all of the lights. The only illumination now is from the screensaver on Randy's laptop, which is running animations of colliding galaxies.
I think we can stipulate that the wall in front of you, Randy, is considerably flatter and smoother, i.e., it generally gives you a much more accurate shadow than his wall, and yet it's clear that he's still capable of seeing the same shadows and probably drawing some useful conclusions about the shapes of the things that cast them.
Okay, so the Athena that you honor on your medallion isn't a supernatural being
who lives on a mountain in Greece, etc., but rather whatever entity, pattern, trend, or what have you that, when perceived by ancient Greek people and filtered through their perceptual machinery and their pagan worldview, produced the internal mental representation that they dubbed Athena. The distinction being quite important, because Athena, the supernatural chick with the helmet, is, of course, non-existent. But Athena, the external generator of the internal representation dubbed Athena by the ancient Greeks, must have existed back then, or else the internal representation never would have been generated. And if she existed back then, the chances are excellent that she exists now. And if all that is the case, then whatever ideas the ancient Greeks, who, though utter shitheads in many ways, were terrifyingly intelligent people, had about her are probably still quite valid.
Okay, but why Athena and not Demeter or someone?
Well, it's a truism that you can't understand a person without knowing something about her family background, and so we have to do kind of a quick Cliff's Note number on the ancient Greek theogony here. We start out with chaos, which is where all theogonies start, and which I like to think of as a sea of white noise, totally random broadband static. And for reasons that we don't really understand, certain polarities begin to coalesce from this. Day, night, darkness, light, earth, sea. Personally, I like to think of these as crystals. Not in the hippy-dippy Californian sense, but in the hard-ass technical sense of resonators, that received certain channels buried in the static of chaos. At some point, out of certain incestuous couplings among such entities, you get titans. And it's arguably kind of interesting to note that the titans provide really the full complement of basic gods. You've got the sun god Hyperion and an ocean god Oceanus, and so on. But they all get overthrown in a power struggle called the Titanomachia, and replaced with new gods like Apollo and Poseidon, who end up filling the same slots in the organizational chart, as it were, which is kind of interesting in that it seems to tie in with what I was saying about the same entities or patterns persisting through time, but casting slightly different shaped shadows for different people. Anyway, so now we have the gods of Olympus as we normally think of them. Zeus, Hera, and so on. A couple of basic observations about these. First, they all, with one exception I'll get to soon, were produced by some kind of sexual coupling, either titan, titaness, or god-goddess, or god-nymph, or god-woman, or basically Zeus and whom, or whatever Zeus was fucking on any particular day. Which brings me to the second basic observation, which is that the gods of Olympus are the most squalid and dysfunctional family imaginable. And yet there is something about the motley asymmetry of this pantheon that makes it more credible, like the periodic table of the elements, or the family tree of the elementary particles, or just about any anatomical structure that you might pull up out of a cadaver. It has enough of a pattern to give our minds something to work on, and yet an irregularity that indicates some kind of organic providence. You have a sun god and a moon goddess, for example, which is all clean and symmetrical. And yet over here is Hera, who has no rule whatsoever except to be a literal bitch goddess. And then there is Dionysus, who isn't even fully a god. He's half-human, but gets to be in the pantheon anyway and sit on Olympus with the gods, as if you went to the Supreme Court and found Bozo the Clown planted among the justices. Now, what I'm getting to here is that Athena was exceptional in every way. To begin with, she wasn't created through sexual reproduction in any kind of normal sense. She sprang fully formed from the head of Zeus. According to some versions of the story, this happened after Zeus fucked Metis, about whom we'll hear more in due course. Then he was warned that Metis would later give birth to a son who would dethrone him, and so he ate her, and later Athena came out of his head. Whether you buy into the Metis story or not, I think we can still agree that something a little peculiar was going on with the nativity of Athena. She was also exceptional in that she did not participate in the moral squalor of Olympus. She was a virgin.
Uh-huh, I knew that was a picture of a virgin on your medallion.
Yes, Randy, you do have a keen eye for virgins. Hephaestus leg-fucked her once, but did not achieve penetration. She's quite important in the Odyssey, and there are really very few myths in the usual sense of that term that involve her. The one exception really proves the rule, the story of Arachne. Arachne was a superb weaver who became arrogant and began taking credit herself instead of attributing her talent to the gods. Arachne went so far as to issue an open challenge to Athena, who was the goddess of weaving, among other things. Now, keep in mind that the typical Greek myth goes something like this. Innocent shepherd boy is minding his own business. An overflying god spies him and gets a hard-on, swoops down and rapes him silly. While the victim is still staggering around in a daze, that god's wife or lover, in a jealous rage, turns him, the helpless, innocent victim, that is, into, let's say, an immortal turtle, and, e.g., power staples him to a sheet of plywood with a dish of turtle food just out of his reach, and leaves him out in the sun forever, to be repeatedly disemboweled by army ants and stung by hornets or something. So if Arachne had dissed anyone else in the pantheon, she would have been just a smoking hole in the ground before she knew what hit her. But in this case, Athena appeared to her in the guise of an old woman, and recommended that she display the proper humility. Arachne declined her advice. Finally, Athena revealed herself as such and challenged Arachne to a weaving contest, which you'll have to admit was uncommonly fair-minded of her. And the interesting thing is that the contest turned out to be a draw. Arachne really was just as good as Athena. Only problem was that her weaving depicted the gods of Olympus at their shepherd-raping interspecies fucking worst. This weaving was simply a literal and accurate illustration of all of those other myths, which makes this into a sort of metamyth. Athena flew off the handle and whacked Arachne with her distaff, which might seem kind of like poor anger management until you consider that during the struggle against the giants, she wasted Enceladus by dropping Sicily on him. The only effect was to cause Arachne to recognize her own hubris, at which she became so ashamed that she hanged herself. Athena then brought her back to life in the form of a spider. So, anyway, you probably learned in elementary school that Athena wears a helmet, carries a shield called Aegis, and is the goddess of war and of wisdom as well as crafts, such as the aforementioned weaving. Kind of an odd combination, to say the least, especially since Ares was supposed to be the god of war and Hestia the goddess of home economics. Why the redundancy? But a lot's been screwed up in the translation. See, the kind of wisdom that we associate with old farts, like yours truly, and which I'm trying to impart to you here, Randy Waterhouse, was called Dike by the Greeks. That's not what Athena was the goddess of. She was the goddess of Metis, which means cunning or craftiness, and which, you'll recall, was the name of her mother in one version of the story. Interestingly, Metis, the personage, not the attribute, provided young Zeus with the potion that caused Cronus to vomit up all of the baby gods he'd swallowed, setting the stage for the whole Titanomachia,